Master's thesis was the United States' role in the formation of the United Nations. He went on to earn his PhD also at Berkeley. His doctoral dissertation was entitled United States Military Policy and the Preparations for War 1918 through 1940. He served in World War II from 1942 to 1946. He has attended and spoken at and lectured at what I would discern to be the majority or most of our intelligence schools conducted by different branches of the armed forces. He is an expert on intelligence issues. And without any further introduction, Professor Rood.
Thank you very much. Well, not really an expert, just terribly good. Well, we've been talking about the strategic balance, so perhaps we ought to remind ourselves of the nature of strategy and of its purpose. We all know this intuitively, but it doesn't hurt to review it. The purpose of strategy is to so place an adversary that he may follow only the courses of action that will lead him to defeat while destroying the material means that he might use to resist that defeat. The ultimate strategy is to confront an adversary with such a preponderance of power and such a superiority of strategic position that he cannot offer battle with any hope of victory. Under those circumstances, the adversary may accept defeat without a struggle, or struggle and be defeated in any case. It is, it seems to me, inattention to such considerations in peacetime that lead to defeat in battle and may ultimately lead to defeat in war. It is inattention and carelessness about strategic matters in peacetime that render even a victory in war costly to ourselves. Strategic superiority includes the possession of military, naval, and air forces strong enough and competent enough successfully to engage and defeat the armed forces of the enemy. And the possession of strategic positions from which to deploy the military, naval, and air forces in such a fashion to destroy the enemy's capability to wage war, and to do so with the least possible expenditure of the lives of those who fight on our side. In 1942, in January, it is interesting to remark, on the Caribbean Sea frontier in the Gulf of Mexico and on the Panamanian Sea frontier, the Allies lost 276 merchant ships, which amounted to about 1.5 million tons of shipping. That included a large percentage of oil tankers carrying oil outward bound to the Allies or inward bound to the United States, ships carrying aluminum for the American war industry and the Allied war industry. Well, that was inflicted by perhaps 8 to 12 German submarines who had, in the year just past, been redeployed to the French coast. That is to say, the loss of France would inflict strategic damage on the United States because German submarines would now have the range to operate in the Gulf of Mexico and the Caribbean. At a time when the Allies were losing 1.5 million tons of shipping in the Caribbean, in the Gulf of Mexico. The Allies were losing in the North Atlantic somewhere in the neighborhood of 500,000 tons of shipping a month. In the month of August alone, there were 652,000 tons of shipping lost to German submarines. That, in short, the losses in the Caribbean were not the only losses being sustained. Admiral Donets wrote of this campaign in the Caribbean. The Americans obviously could not provide adequate protection for all focal points at all times, and they would be compelled to follow us from one to another. In this way, it seems likely that we could compel the enemy to a real dispersal of his defensive forces. And that indeed is what happened, because a whole hunter-killer group, escort group, had to be diverted from the North Atlantic in order to help save shipping in the Caribbean, because the United States had no adequate anti-submarine forces available in the Caribbean, despite the fact that the Allied war had been going on for 3 years and that we had been preparing for it vigorously before our own entry. But that wasn't the only thing. In August in 1942, the British attempted to run the pedestal convoy through to supply Malta. The force included 2 battleships, 5 aircraft carriers, 7 cruisers, 28 destroyers, 150 Fleet Air Arm aircraft, some 18 Royal Air Force squadrons besides. And in order to get the convoy through, some 34 aircraft were lost, an aircraft carrier was lost, 3 cruisers were lost, half dozen destroyers. And when one speaks of those losses, one must not consider them carelessly. A lot of Allied people went down with those ships. And that was in order to get to escort a convoy of 19 merchant ships from Southampton through to Malta, of which 4 merchant ships got through. Now, that's a very expensive strategic lesson to learn, which the British should have known already, that the British had lost the northern coast of the Mediterranean. The Germans and Italians were in Libya and in Egypt as well, so that every ship was subjected to air attack as well as submarine attack as well as surface force attack as a consequence of the proximity of enemy bases. And that was a consequence of British military policy. The United States hadn't much to do with the Mediterranean at the time. The United States did have a great deal to do with the Caribbean and the Gulf of Mexico at the time, and yet we were inadequately prepared for that war there. I point that out to you. I know it's only a historic curiosity, perhaps, but that if you think of the impact of a half dozen of submarines based on Cuba operating against the oil platforms off the Gulf Coast, against the bauxite trade, and against the somewhere around 50% of the oil coming into the United States comes in through the Gulf of Mexico into the United States. That, in short, the loss of Cuba was a serious strategic loss which we tolerated out of a misplaced sense of goodwill in 1962, and which we have continued to tolerate. The failure, it seems to me, to support Britain and France at Suez in 1956 is perhaps another example, which we continue to pay for. The consequences of that defeat of the British and French and our own failure to support them was that the canal slipped from the hands of the Allies into the hands of a now uncertain ally, Egypt, that the fact that Britain and France no longer controlled the canal meant for Britain that they had no reason, as it turned out, to remain east of Suez. And that where the British were once in Aden, who do you suppose succeeded them there? The Soviet Union. And that is a dramatic change in the strategic balance in that area when you come to consider the safety of the Persian Gulf. Further than that, in the course of the war in Vietnam, had the British and French retained their interests east of Suez and in the Middle East, they would have supported us in Vietnam. But since they had no interests with the loss of Suez anymore, the United States had virtually to go it alone. And the condition and outcome of that war might have been dramatically different. The loss of Libya in 1969 meant that in 1973, the States resist the Soviet ultimatum that the Israelis must withdraw from the West Bank of the canal under the threat that the Soviets would intervene, because we could not operate our carriers east of the Sicilian Narrows because of Soviet air in Yugoslavia, in Libya, and at that time in Egypt, that we would simply have lost those carriers and they would have had no effect. The defeat in Vietnam, of course, is self-evident. Vietnam, which we were assured would become, if not a new liberal democracy once unified, at least a rather decent regime, once they got rid of the tyrant that was running South Vietnam. Vietnam is now a base for Soviet naval and air operations in the South China Sea, by coincidence, accident, or by strategic direction. It doesn't really matter. Remember that it was from Saigon that the first air attacks were launched against Singapore, and that Indochina was the mobilization and concentration point for the Japanese campaign to seize the Philippines, the Netherlands, East Indies, Malaya, and Singapore, and to operate on southward toward Australia. What I am suggesting, then, is that it is not merely important to have a commitment to a strong armed forces that is essential to national survival, that there must be a concern for the preservation of superiority of strategic position, even in peacetime, and that must become as much a part of our being and as much a part of American consciousness as is our commitment to the civil rights of our citizens. Failure in either respect will lead to the destruction of the Constitution. Those are considerations that do not follow party lines. They are neither liberal or conservative. They transcend party lines. Those are national considerations. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Rode.